And now, the starting lineup for your
Gangsters. What's up, guys?
Are you a slacker?
MVP.
I'm not going to debate you, Jerry.
God bless the internet.
What the hell's going on out here?
Hello and welcome to Flicking and Screaming. I am Jed Sprague here with my co-hosts, Evan Fagundes.
Hey.
And a man who did, in fact, get a callback from Juilliard, but didn't take it because his best friend didn't get one, and that's Mr. JT Chipman.
I'm loyal to my friends. What can I say?
And this week we are talking about Theater Camp, the Molly Gordon, I think, vehicle, we could say, as she's co-directed and one of the main stars, but Ben Platt and Molly Gordon, among many others. Excited to talk about this one. This is not one I had slated for the pod. This is one I had slated for myself. And so when it got brought up as a potential pod, I was very, very excited. Before we get into that, gentlemen, how are we doing? Evan, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing so well. I was just talking about it a little bit, catching you guys up, but it was my birthday this last Friday. And I got to have a great celebration over the weekend, friends, family. It was a really good time. So you guys know how it is. You know, sometimes coming off a great weekend, whether it's like a trip or a birthday or a holiday or something, you can just be kind of flying high for the next few days. So I'm really trying to ride this wave as long as possible. Chip, how are you feeling today?
I'm doing really good. Recently attended a taping of Beetlejuice the Musical, and it went super normal. For me, I really had a good time and haven't logged onto the internet lately, so hopefully everything's kosher there. But I'm doing really good. Jed, what's up with you?
I'm hanging in there. I'm not gonna lie, I'm not doing the best I've ever done, but you know, we are hanging in and happy to be on the pod. This is a nice reprieve from normal life. And I was so happy when I was watching this movie yesterday. Because I was like, wow, there's actually a surprising amount to talk about. And I laughed a lot when watching this movie, which I think most I've laughed in a movie in a while. Just pure kind of like unadulterated cringe laughter. And I think, is that the point of this movie, Evan? Is it cringe laughter, or is it about an endearing story about a summer theater camp?
I think the movie, and it is Molly Gordon and Nick Lieberman is the other co-director of this film. I think it's both. It's definitely going for both, right? Like the people who created this movie, it's actually written by four different people, three of which perform in the movie. So it clearly is a very personal piece. And I feel like you can feel that in there. And they're going for both. The comedy is what I really took away from this movie, and it is pure cringe comedy. And we can talk a little bit about the similarities and differences to shows like, you know, The Office and stuff like that that also go for a sort of cringe comedy. And I think there are plenty of differences, even though, you know, the shooting style is the same sometimes, or at least similar. But man, this movie is really funny. And I'm not saying those other moments didn't work, but when I was leaving the theater, I definitely wasn't thinking about the Juilliard revelation. I was thinking about Jimmy Tatro dancing while a kid a cappella sings Post Malone, you know, like that. That's the type of stuff that I was going for. And it was incredibly uncomfortable at a lot of points.
Chip, as our resident theater guy, what do you think of this fine piece?
Well, I need to clarify right off the bat that I was a theater guy, but I was not a musical theater guy. I never appeared in any music. We didn't even actually perform.
So you appeared in no gay plays, straight plays only.
Well, in more than one way, my friend, let me tell you. I had a really good and entertaining time here, I would say. It definitely, like, it was cringe, but it was like a self-effacing kind of cringe comedy, you know? And it wasn't like this was shot mockumentary style, so you're right to bring up The Office, but it wasn't interview-style mockumentary. There wasn't a lot of looking at the camera. There wasn't, you know, quote-unquote gym faces being made towards the lens, which I think once it started, because I didn't know it was mockumentary, once it started, I got really nervous that I was going to be in for that. And it was a really smart choice to not do it, to shoot it mockumentary, but just to let the actors actually act, you know, naturally and organically, as if the cameras really aren't there. And that was a really good choice. And it's also a good choice, I think, to have the main crew, the adults, performers, also work on the directing team and on the writing team and on the producing team. And you look at like the top five or six names of this movie in terms of actors, and they're also writing, they're also producing. Like there's that creative, those creative juices, I think, are just very much flowing amongst this team. And I think that really helped. And they all bring such individual experiences and styles of humor. Tatro is bringing Tatro things to the table. We were talking about this beforehand. I mean, he's basically just kind of playing himself and doing his whole shtick that he's built up for 10 years. Ben Platt is obviously pulling from his massive musical theater experience. He's probably pulling off of teachers that he had or experiences that he had at theater camp. There's so much cringe, but there's also, I think, some sincerity and love for these characters that they're creating. And I think it really, really worked. I'm really happy to say.
I think you're right. And I think part of it is so self-aware from these, like all these people that made this clearly have like a lot of affection for the theater and, you know, the lowercase T theater, right? Like high school drama, collegiate drama, and like what it feels like a love letter to like what they got out of it, while also acknowledging like exactly how cringe and like how ridiculous it can be, you know, both making fun of themselves and making fun of people they interacted with. And that's what I think why the comedy works, is because it felt so honest. It didn't feel like they were really like taking a big swing for a lot of their digs. It just felt like these were the types of characters that would inhabit this place, and we have cameras on them. And I think for me, like you said, like everybody's kind of playing to their strengths, but I thought what they did a good job of is they populated, you know, the camp with a lot of like stereo, like kind of stereotypical camp counselor type people that you would associate with theater. But then they also, you know, popped in like an A.O. Atterbury character, where she's basically just like lied on her resume to get a job for the summer. And she's just kind of there. And
I don't think she's like been in a play before.
No, you know? No, exactly. Like she's literally like, what is stage combat? And everyone's answering. And but what is it?
Like in the dictionary.
Yeah. Like so you're just like, yeah, it's when you fight. Oh, okay.
In the
cool.
Legals. What's the legal sense?
Yeah,
the no, legal.
And it's just perfect because it's like that is relatable to like anybody, even if you never experienced theater. But I think it's a movie of performances. And so I kind of want to start there. Like who is your guys' standout performer of the film?
I might give some props here to Noah Galvin. Mm-hmm. Probably I think third or fourth build, and someone that I don't think I was like, okay, I know Ben Platt, AO, Tatro. Like, I'm like, okay, I know these folks coming in. But what Noah Galvin does is, I mean, first of all, like establishing that friendship with Tatro as the tech guy, you know, Tatro is the only one who like actually takes the time and to have a conversation with the tech guy, aside from requesting a ridiculous prop to be brought to a stage. Right. So it's fun to see that character develop, and that character like has so much love and passion for the theater in a different way, in a way that is expressed very differently than these other characters. Right. See, when the turn hits for Galvin's character, and I guess I won't spoil it in case anyone wants to listen to it.
No, it's a spoil. It's, I mean, we're going to spoil this podcast. Please. Yeah. Stop now.
Yes. When Galvin takes the stage, as Joan,
Old Joan. It's so
good. In like, but also like in a perfect makeup, perfect costume. Like it made me really happy. I kind of saw it coming, because they teased it a little bit with dancing on the stage with the spotlight when he's like training the tech crew, and he's like, this is really easy, can you make it harder? That kid was hilarious, by the way.
Yeah, the humming too.
Yes.
When he's humming, fixing the breaker, and the kid's like, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, they tease it really well. But also knowing that, like, I mean, he's engaged to Ben Platt. He was a chief writer on this. So you can kind of tell that, like, he wrote himself that role a little bit, which is pretty fun. But he's definitely the performance I've thought about the most since watching it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's my favorite moment of the film, is when he is just like up there as old Joan, and Ben Platt's like watching him the whole time. You see his expression continue to change, and then finally he just goes, God, he's good. But God, he's good. And it's like hilarious, because it's like at that moment, right, he's so swept up in his own like the play that he brought to life, right? The musical that he brought to life, that he can't even like have the self-awareness to realize that it is a grown man playing a woman in a play that they wrote for children to perform. He's just like, God, just absolutely embodying the character right now, which is absolutely incredible. I agree with you. I think Noah Galvin for me was unreal. Evan, I know you want to sing his praises as well.
I'll pick somebody else, but the last thing that I'll say about him, one, he was involved in the funniest scene in the movie, which I want to get to later, in my opinion, the funniest moment, but also he was such a relatable character because everyone in this movie, and why it works so well in the mockumentary style, I think, is that there's no barrier to entry of being like, okay, this isn't how normal people would act, but like, let's go along with it. Like these people are performing at all times. So like the fact that they would continue performing with documentary cameras there makes complete sense. And he's like the only character in the movie that seems at all nervous to perform. And it makes him very relatable throughout the movie because I'm kind of like, yeah, I wouldn't want to do this shit either. Like, it looks so scary to be a kid up there, like, singing a song in front of, like, six adults just staring at you, you know, actively saying we can't give any feedback. So I thought he was great. I'm going to take Molly Gordon, though. I absolutely died at almost everything that she said. I thought something that works so well in the movie, too, is, like, it's cringy comedy, but sort of like what you're getting at, Jed, they're not being mean about it at all because these people who made this movie clearly love this type of person and clearly love being around these people. So they can recognize, it's almost like, it reminds me of the people who are sports fans and realize it's ridiculous to have season tickets. They're not saying you should never do that. They respect the people who do, but they're like, we can make fun of people who like literally go to 81 baseball games in a year. Still, you know, like that's okay to do while still loving them. And she just like totally bodied that. Like every single moment that she's in, she's just like performing to the max, including especially when she would do her fake like seances and speak to the dead. It was such a committed bit that she was doing both in the movie and as an actor. It was so good.
I'm sure she's been in a seance. Maybe she's fucking led a seance. I don't know. But it's like we can make fun of us. You can't make fun of us because you don't actually know us, but we can more accurately make fun of us.
Yes.
Yeah, 100%. I think, Evan, you said something there that almost made me think that you were getting ready to work up a theater camp is basically like Fever Pitch, but for a musical theater take.
It crossed the mind. This is better, but it crossed the mind.
I was laughing so hard just thinking about the take forming in my head. I agree. I really, honestly, like Molly Gordon's kind of been on my radar just because I think because she was in The Bear season two. I kind of like retroactively remember her in Booksmart. You know, it's not somebody that you're like, oh yeah, like Molly Gordon's performance in Booksmart, but then you watch it again, you're like, oh wow, really, really good. I think for somebody that again gets a lot of stick, not necessarily on this podcast, but just like in general, in Ben Platt, I thought his performance was like definitely the most straight and like the most sincere. And I think like they purposely didn't give him a lot of like direct comedy, you know, like he's kind of carrying like a lot of the emotion weight. And I think that seemingly is a choice. And I think the best thing I can say about his performance is like, I was most apprehensive of this movie because of him. And not necessarily, I don't know, it's like, I feel bad saying that because it's like, I don't necessarily, like when I think about Ben Platt, I'm not like, oh, I dislike him terribly as an actor, but it's more like this aura of him. Like, he, I guess, is, like, the one, like, true movie star, right, in this. Like, he is, like, a star, and I think he carries a little bit of the negative connotation of that with him over the last couple of years. And I thought that he was actually pretty good, and I actually enjoyed his performance in this. So I wanted to give him a shout-out as well.
I mean, yeah, you're referring to Dear Evan Hansen, essentially, right? Like, that's what we're referring to.
Yeah,
I mean, but what I mean, else was he in that he was, like, derided for?
I think what's it called?
Do people not like him in Pitch Perfect?
I thought he was okay in Pitch Perfect, but I don't know. I also haven't.
Pitch Perfect is like where he came on the scene, and everyone's like, oh, like this, like look at this guy. And then I think he has like since Pitch Perfect, he's like continually drawn the ire of a lot of like the musical theater community. There's another one that he's in. It was like with Gwyneth Paltrow, Netflix.
The Politician.
Is a TV show. Yeah, that was tough. But he also is like playing an insufferable character. But yeah, I think between like The Politician, I think Dear Evan Hansen, like there's a lot of ill will towards Ben.
Yeah, I think this movie surrounds him with equally, if not more, insufferable people, which helps. So we can kind of blend in as opposed to being like a sore thumb, like, oh, look at this insufferable motherfucker. And he's also like, he kind of gets to be a little bit over it at a couple of points and kind of serve it back to the kids when he's like, I forget the character's name, but he like asks one of the kids to like perform an exercise. And he's like, okay, that's completely wrong. And here's why it's wrong. And so he actually dishes it back. I think he tends to be a bit of a punching bag and gets made fun of in a lot of other things. And that just becomes like annoying. It's like, okay, this guy you just get punched in the face over and over again.
You could just feel all the set she's been on dripping off of her. Like that
Yes, that works for him.
I also love that don't internalize that feedback. We're not supposed to be giving live feedback. Just saying, like, don't internalize something to a kid who just heard something is funny. But he is quite good in this movie. And I feel like it's telling that his character is all vulnerability, right? Like, his character is a walking insecurity. I mean, his insecurities come out the second you see him and talk to him. And I think that there's something about that that is endearing because, you know, he is an unlikable character through most of the movie because you can tell he's holding his friend back. You can tell he's kind of dominating people. And there really isn't a ton of moments where it shows him like being bullied a ton or something to be like, oh, this is why he's so bitter. You know, it's more just like, he's an insecure guy, just like lots of us are. And he kind of makes the people's lives around him suck because he feels insecure all the time. And he has to work through that.
100%. I think that you kind of nailed on something that I think makes the character work for me. And is that they don't give that explanation. Like he's not like other than like the not getting into Juilliard thing. Like he's just not, it's not like he was tortured. You know, it's just like he's just kind of a mean control freak, you know, bit of a bully, and he likes the theater camp because he gets to teach and be in control. And like, but that doesn't mean that he's outside, like that doesn't mean that he's in it for all the wrong reasons, right? He clearly gets a lot out of like actually making an impact, as they show like later in the movie, right? He likes teaching more than he likes performing, is basically,
and the kids love him, right? Like I feel like it's very telling, that scene when Teichiro can't get their attention at the beginning and he walks up and is immediately able to get them and they all cheer for him. Like, it establishes early on that even when he's critical, like the kids still revere him.
Yeah, and exactly. And even Darla, who is, you know, the one that like who's the, you know, the main actress at camp, and he kind of goes out of his way to be a dick to her and be, you know, be rude. And she still is like craving his feedback and craving like some one-on-one coaching with him. Which is funny.
Here's a not PC opinion. Teachers need to be dicks sometimes. A little bit. I think teachers need to be a little bit of an asshole to bring out the best in people in an appropriate way.
Noted.
Hot take corner. Talk about it, Chip.
Yeah, it's, let us know, Chip. Are you saying we're coddling the youth of America today?
Participation trophies all around.
Exactly. Exactly. I think this is also influenced by recently watching Remember the Titans because Denzel's character in that movie is an extreme version of this, and we'll talk about that on a future podcast.
You've been watching a lot of listening to a lot of Tucker's podcast, huh? For coddling the youth of America. We need teachers to just be assholes sometimes.
Exactly. Happy to announce that I'm going to be doing some substitute teaching on the side as well going forward. I'll report back on that.
Okay, so we talked a lot about you know, some of like the main performers. I don't know if we talked enough about Teichiro. Maybe we'll just save him for the end because he's kind of an interesting case.
Funny moments with both he and Io, I feel like could be some good. They both were part of funny moments, but didn't feel necessarily like as pivotal a character.
Agree. Who was your favorite a character that performer that like populated the outskirts of this movie?
Caroline Aaron.
Caroline Krause.
Her when she's like when the lakeside like bus is going past and she's like, this is a bucolic setting. She's like had 17 marbles with her oatmeal that morning.
Yes.
She's great because, you know, she's not like the theater person, right?
Sorry.
And I think like,
I misheard you. So you're talking about Caroline Aaron, who plays Rita, right? The right hand.
Jones' friend. Yes. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Cool. Exactly. Exactly. So she's like an executive, an administrator, you know. I think at one point she does kind of do one of the bedtime stories for the kids, but it's clear that she is a little more hands off with the actual artistic side, which is why she gets to come in and just like drop a couple of haymakers and then go away for 20 minutes at a time. But because that character is such a memorable voice, because she's in that very first scene and has some funny lines right away, she's someone that I was always excited to see pop back up on the screen.
Definitely. Yeah. The person I thought you were talking about was Patty Harrison, who plays Caroline Krause, who is the like hedge fund representative that's basically negotiating with Tatro. I don't know what I know her from, but every time I see her pop up, I think she like does a lot of voice acting, like a lot of like Big Mouth. She's in American. I think she did some stuff for like American Dad too, but like I've seen her face pop up in some things, and I just like always, for whatever reason, I've always like, when I saw her pop up, I was like, why do I know her and why do I think she's always hilarious?
She's very funny. Yeah. She, you know, what I remember her being in was A Simple Favor, that movie a few years ago.
Yeah.
Anna Kendrick and Blake Lively.
Yes.
That movie was just going viral for like, remember when this came out and everyone was like,
and she was in
do people remember this?
She was in Lost City too. That's
Yes. She is very funny.
Yeah, she's pretty funny. But I really liked her, but I think if my favorite person that populates the outside of this movie has to be Nathan Lee Graham, who plays Clive, the dance teacher.
Yeah.
I mean, that was just, talk about haymakers, just absolutely throwing darts the entire movie. Like anytime they cut to him for a comedic moment, it was just no question about it. It was going to get nailed.
Get out. Get out when he's yelling at Tatro. Yes.
I think my favorite at the end is when they miss a tap. They miss a step in the tap dancing number, and he goes, "Oh, missed a step right there." And the Rita character's like, "Oh, I didn't even notice. Nobody noticed." He goes, "I'd prefer just to move on. Like, we don't need to talk about it. Let's just move on."
He also had a great moment when they cut. They're kind of doing a montage, and they cut to him doing like the performance of the night, which I also thought was like one of the greatest bits of the movie. And he's just going ham in that tiny little bunk.
Yeah. Wearing his Toms. It is like, it was just so, so good.
So question, now that we're talking about side characters, Patty Harrison's character was honestly a character I thought was going to factor in a bit more. She kind of was like real plot device-y, like, cause she'd be in and out, like whenever they needed to actually have something happen.
Yeah.
Was it not jarring that she and Tatro like slept together? Didn't that almost feel like it was like a deleted scene or something like that?
I totally got the vibe that you were, I almost feel like it was like a total swipe at just like, she would have done anything to get the signature.
It felt like it was definitely the meanest part of the movie, and it seemed telling that in this movie, by far the meanest thing that the meanest thing they did to anyone was have her do that, and she's like the big city like finance lady.
Yeah,
you know, like everyone else is like given the benefit of the doubt, and she's like, because she was kind of dominating Tatro in conversations, and there was like a little bit of like a almost like a chemistry just because. Just because there was versus
she played down to his level.
I was just really, like almost thrown off for like 3 minutes after that scene. I was like, did that actually happen or was that like a dream?
I think Tatro was like, I'm gonna fuck in this movie.
He's like, no. I'm just like, and I don't know if I'm this entire movie. I need to have sex.
I don't know if I'm conflating his like on screen personality with who he is in real life.
I think that's exactly. Like, I think that's exactly what you're doing. I don't. I mean. I just
felt like, and I guess maybe the point would sort of be like, they're made for each other in a way. Like, I don't know,
I can't imagine my beloved Zoe Deutsch is, with someone who, his actual personality is like, I just got to fuck. Like, to be in this movie, I just need to fuck.
Well, what really was jarring about it too, I felt was like at the end, then she comes back around. And that's really funny when she comes back with the construction guys. Like, yeah. I love when they're like doing the rehearsal and they're taking
I'm in the middle of something.
Of carpet.
Oh, nice. We're in the middle of something too.
We're in the middle of something too. Yeah, that's true. And but then she like, you know, at the show, she's sitting behind him like, oh, do you think this is working? And I thought we were going to kind of get the cuts to like they got engaged 6 months later, you know, like when they're doing like the explanation. And there's nothing like that. It's literally just like, I guess she just slept with him in order for him to sign the paperwork.
Yeah, I did. But I honestly didn't even like. I didn't almost believe that,
or that
they
was
slept
secondary.
Together. I almost didn't believe that they slept together. I was more of like a she got him hammered, stayed there to make him think that like
it was like too late. Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. Weird. I don't know.
I don't know. I don't need to like.
She was fully wearing her suit. She was wearing her pants suit.
She was. She was wearing
her
pants suit.
And like they didn't.
They were laying on the floor.
He said last night was like amazing, right? Like I don't remember, but like, I don't know. I didn't quite square that.
He's like last night was so hot, is what he says. I think.
Yeah. Exactly.
Just such a crazy thing to
say. Squad. Fam.
Fam.
The original ballers. The original ballers, man. All right. Anybody else you want to shout out before we move on to some of our favorite moments of the movie?
Can we talk about kid actors? Because they're not too bad in this movie. Yeah. So okay, here's the thing. I kind of like sat with it and I kind of have like this whole spiel on it, right? I realized so the moment when they get on the loudspeaker and they say cast lists are up. And you see a montage of all the kids rushing to the board. Jimmy Tatro is like looking out his office window. What is this stampede happening? But there's so many quick cuts of like the kids' faces, like perusing the boards, looking for their name, not finding, then reacting. It's very authentic. And, you know, they kind of overplay it. But also, these are all drama kids. They're all theater kids. So it makes sense if the kids are extra hammy. Mm-hmm. It makes sense if their reactions are unrealistic, or if they're maybe, you know, if they're trying to act older than they are, it makes sense because they're taking on these roles of like adults with very real and sometimes very strange problems in these plays that they're putting on. And also just like having a lot of kids helps as well, because you can kind of spread the love a little bit. No one outside of Darla, no one kid really needs to carry a ton of emotional weight. There's very small emotional stakes, like with the tear stick moment mm-hmm. where they confront the kid for cheating, essentially.
So
which
good.
Is really funny.
So good.
Like, those stakes feel a lot more muted compared to like it's not a kid that solves really the problem of Troy and solves the, you know, a lesser movie. The kids like actually solve the problem. Now they're in the performances, right? But those emotional confrontations are backed by the adult supporting cast. So they don't ask too much of the kids. They spread it out amongst a large group of kids. And also, they're just all ham bones. They're just all a bunch of hams at theater camp, and it works for their characters.
Yeah, I thought Alexander Bello, who plays the kid who is performing the Bye Bye Birdie musical in the beginning when Joan has the, like, I thought he was a standout the whole time. Mm-hmm. Like, when he's relaying what happened, when he's like, I'm just absolutely crushing this. Yes. And then I look over, and she's on the floor. I don't know what happened.
He's like, of course I stayed in character.
Yeah, I love that. And then I thought, we mentioned her earlier, but Vivian Sachs, who she was kind of Glenn's like right hand, like theater tech woman, the one that's like the spotlight is too easy.
Yes.
The one that's like bring on the cocaine or cue the cocaine or something in the end, which is hilarious.
I really like Alan Kim, the kid who is like the little agent.
Yeah, so... He hilarious. Alan Kim. What else has Alan Kim played Alan in? Oh, he's in Minari.
Yeah, he's in Minari.
Isn't he Alan? Is he Alan in Minari?
No way.
Alan? What's he Alan?
He was fantastic in Minari.
Yeah, what's he yes. Alan?
No. He's David. He's David.
David. Okay.
His name is Alan. Oh yeah, he was Alan Park in Theater Camp. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, he was spectacular in Minari. I was wondering where I recognized him.
Yeah, he's such a cute little kid. And, like, he does have that face where he looks like he's just, like, a little man.
Yeah.
You know, like with his suit on. That I love that scene when when he goes to the other office. She get off the phone, and then like she picks it up and it's
1 second.
I also loved at the end when he's sitting next to A.I. Atterbury at the play, and then he sees Glenn, you know, a grown ass man on the stage performing. He goes, "Who's that kid? I'm gonna make him a star.
Yeah."
And he reads A.O. Atterbury for her rights too, and he's like, "You're a liar. You could be an agent."
Yeah, I love that. So,
that in a way that like that line is kind of, I'm sure that Platt and Co. have had some run-ins with agents that they felt like taking a little swipe at.
Absolutely.
And then last one I want to shout out was Donovan Colon, who plays he plays Devin. Who I thought he was pretty funny. It was his first summer at camp. He's the one that sings Post Malone.
The one who comes and out then, as heterosexual.
Yeah. And then plays football and comes out as hetero. That was a good joke.
He's like, they said no one from theater camp could catch a football or could throw a football.
And he's like, I don't think he's doing some amazing.
It's a full moon. We were manifesting.
He's not like some superstar athlete. He's just like, yeah, I can throw a halfway decent spiral. It makes him the greatest athlete that camp has ever seen.
Yeah, so good. I agree. I thought the kids were, you know, part of it. I think all the reaction shots were so good, and that gets into you know, Jed, I don't know if we want to piggyback off this, but like I thought this movie looked really, really good.
Yeah, no, that's
great.
This
movie looked really good, and I think a big part of that was the way they shot the kids, like the way they would montage them running through the camp and stuff, like when the task list came out or the cast list came out. I just thought it was really effective and like looked really fun.
I loved what they did is they used the documentary style only to their advantage and were felt free to abandon it when it did not serve them. Yeah. And I think like that was a really smart decision. They used it to serve them, right? When they were doing like those kind of cut and quick zoom shots, you know, when they're in a big room or shooting through the porthole at the Rotary Club dinner, which we'll get into that, I'm sure. But they use it in really intentional and smart ways. But for things like the kid montage, right? And I think the party too, like the mixer, the annual mixer with Lakeside, like a lot of the way those are shot or some, you know, even some of the like Ben Platt kind of at the end, you know, sitting on the dock feeling sorry for himself shots too. Like those are just out of a movie. Those are not out of a those are not out of a documentary, right?
100%.
And I think that is something that I agree with you, Chip. I get nervous when I see like mock doc style. Because it's like, oh shit, like we're going to see a bunch of, you know, we're going to see a bunch of reaction shots or we're going to see a lot of, you know, things, or it's going to be hamstrung. It won't look as good, but all the montages look great. I think there's something about the way that this is, I don't know what they shot it on. Obviously it's got a lot of film grain.
It does.
And it's got a very distinct like oversaturated kind of 1970s style to it, which I really, really liked. And yeah, I thought it works
shot it. On digital, but they don't, and it, so they kind of add some vintage filters lenses. And some lenses and all that.
Yeah, okay, cool. That makes a lot more sense, because it definitely wasn't like the giveaway is the amount of grain that they have, and like the way the grain is moving is not that is not indicative of like actual film stock, right? But it gives it an old kind of like almost like an old handheld camera look, you know. I mean, it looks like a low budget documentary, which is exactly what I think they're going for.
But not low budget, I think, is what kind of getting at. Like it looks like a documentary and it looks like it's shot a while back, but it still is quite clear. And I think that's like what the choice that they made, probably why they didn't even shoot on film too, is it still comes across very clear, but it does create a very cool, like warm glow to the whole movie. And I think it's very effective for the summer camp vibe. Like this movie feels like summer the whole time that you're watching it, which is really, even inside, like all those stage lights, right? Like it's kind of a director's dream to be able to just put lights out and not have to explain where it comes from. Be like, of course, everything's lit in here. It's a theater. So like, I feel like it's a cool thing for, you know, cinematographers and directors, and they use it well because they create these like really cool warm tones. And you're right, like they get very static, especially like Jed, going back to what you were saying, another example is anytime that they were shooting rehearsals, the camera got very static because you could imagine even a documentary crew could set up like a tripod, right? If they're doing rehearsals, because they're just shooting the stage or shooting like the two directors sitting in front of the stage.
No, I thought it was brilliant, honestly. And I really liked the way it looked. And I think I liked the feel that the look like lended itself to. Like, I think that's what you said, Evan, that I really agree with, is like, it felt like summer camp in every way. I even love like the first night, you know, when the power goes off and they've got all the the candles, and like, it felt nostalgic, but they weren't setting it in the past. Right. Like a lot of the themes are like very modern, the lakeside, all the kids get iPads and investment accounts, right?
Yeah. Speaking of, no technology, basically, right? Like, that is a very interesting thing. So like
the phone, what are you talking about? Like when the kids go there? I mean, I imagine it's a very easy thing to be like at a theater summer camp.
No phones.
It's a no phones situation, right? It's like just,
I think you're right. I thought it was so cool how they didn't explain it. Like, they didn't even have a scene at the very beginning where they're like, everyone turn, like, you know, the manager is like, everyone turn in your phones. But about halfway through the movie, I was like, holy shit, I haven't seen a single phone or like television this entire time. This is nuts.
Which is why it's so good when the finance ballers come in and they have like seven selfie sticks among like three people.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of conversation like that's been had right now about like all of our greatest filmmakers are making movies set in the past because cell phones make things really hard from a storytelling perspective.
Yeah.
I think we just need to say fuck it and just like do things without still use cell phones just for, like calling, but just pretend like texting doesn't exist, or pretend like Google searches on phones like, why do we have to like abide by the rules of like logic in our society? Like when we're making a movie, like this kind of showed me, you can just like write it off and be like, Oh yeah. Like that doesn't, like, I guess it doesn't need to happen. You know, that makes sense.
It's like a stretch, but it can work. So something that like, it reminds me, like Succession didn't do anything with COVID. They were just like, hey, we're gonna like, clearly Trump is in office during Succession. They talk about the crazy guy offhandedly, and they have an election that's contested and all of that. But they never make any sort of pandemic play during the show. And other shows like Grey's Anatomy, which is medical, so that makes sense. But other shows brought COVID in. And if we can erase that from our fiction, why can't we just go along with the cell phone device not being quite as important? That's a good point.
Yeah, that's true. I think of the movies that have done it effectively in like, you know, a movie that lends itself to like Uncut Gems, you know, has cell phones and texting capabilities. But the problem is that none of his problems can be solved with a cell phone, right? Actually, he's like, I'd rather not be able to be reached by like most of the people in the movie. I want to like stay off the grid almost in a way.
Yeah.
So you kind of have to put your character, or at least the filmmaker so far felt like you have to put your characters almost in a situation where they either don't have access to a phone or don't want anything to do with a phone, versus like, you know, all the noir, like imagine like the Nice Guys, you know, you're doing things pretty quickly if you have a cell phone and you're just calling. Like, they wouldn't need to meet up every day at Ryan Gosling's house to like figure out the plan for the day. They would just like text each other, I'm gonna go check out this house, you go check out this other one.
But what I'm saying is like, if you do like, but what I guess that's actually a perfect example of something where like, if you make that and it's set in modern times, right, and Russell Crowe's character just shows up at his house and they make their plan for every day, and then they go together and check things out, and then maybe you add like, you know, a research thing where they're on a computer or they're like looking, Googling something on the phone to be like, we're in modern times. Does anybody complaining and being like, why didn't you just text him? Why'd you have to show up at his house to make a plan for the day? Couldn't you have just called him? Right. No. Like, maybe they just like don't have their, like, I feel like that's what I feel like people cater to the technology too much because they become too aware of it. And then they either use it as a plot device, like in like a lot of those Netflix movies, you know, where like the bubbles are popping up on screen, which is my least fucking favorite thing in the entire world. Like, show me that they're texting and like just give me voiceover if anything. But like, I hate when bubbles pop up on the screen, like do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And it's like, fucking no teenagers even have their phones on ring. Like it would just be vibrations. So what the fuck right. are you doing? But
I agree with you on the ringing, but a decision to leave.
Did yes, you see I was decision just to leave
last
that.
Year, Jed?
No, I haven't. I didn't see it.
See that's the, I mean, it's the exception that proves the rule. But what Park Chan-wook does in that movie with text bubbles, specifically what you're talking about, is absolutely a 10 out of 10. There's like, it's interesting because I think directors like Park Chan-wook and Michael Mann have done some things with technology, and it has been more divisive amongst their fans. But there are some filmmakers who will plunge ahead, I think, with mixed results, perhaps. And I'm curious if more of these established guys and gals out there will try to forge new ground with technology.
I'm also kind of like really enjoying, like, there's this, and then this reminded me a lot of Sex Education in a way, just like as far as like the visual vibe. Evan, do you like that show?
Yeah.
Yeah. But just kind of like how Sex Education just straight up looks like it's out of the 80s, like the with the costume design, all the houses, everything is just like straight up. It is the 80s, like even the cars, everything's in the 80s. But the kids have cell phones and everything is like, as far as we know, set in like modern day. And I kind of just like that. Like, let's just create an aesthetic and let's create a vibe that transports you. And like, who gives a shit like what year it is? You know, like we'll use and not use technology as we see fit. But I don't feel like the story needs to go about explaining it to you. And I think like I feel like that's liberating. Cause like at the end of the day, it's all art, right? And like, who gives a shit? Like, is theater camp any better if it's set in 1970, right? To avoid cell phones, right? Or is it just as good now? Like, you don't even have to change anything about the plot. Like the entire plot basically still works if you set it in an era before the internet and cell phones, but it doesn't, I don't know, it doesn't change anything.
Yeah, it doesn't. And I love, we're really on a tangent here, but I totally agree. I mean, all it does, I actually think it would actively make the movie worse, because then it just becomes nostalgia bait, right? Like then they toss in a couple of Steely Dan songs or something and you're just like, okay, yeah, like I get it, you know, you're all remembering what your parents would talk about at their theater camp, you know, but I actually think it's effective to do it in modern day, and I'm with you. So there's a lot of talk about this, you know, online, right? Like we always say the ambiguous, like online, but how people will sort of say how CinemaSins or like that type of critical reception of movies or that specific type of studying movies has almost kind of like ruined this idea and maybe like had directors scared or writers scared to not use cell phones and stuff like that, right? Because like lots of people will go through frame by frame in a movie and be like, why didn't a character did like, it seems like audiences nowadays really do try to almost break like plot specifically down into the minutia versus accepting like a whole. I mean, we even saw this weekend there was a viral clip going around about somebody saying that Kubrick's, you know, the scene in The Shining with the blood coming out of the elevator would be more effective with CGI because it wouldn't have to be ambiguous, which is just like the most ridiculous possible reading of it, you know, to say that it's not supposed to have ambiguity. But I don't know. Now I'm digressing, but it just does feel like people, or at least filmmakers, think people will like be breaking down their movies and saying, why didn't this person just text this person instead of like,
100%. And it is like the same kind of bullshit, which is the reason that we have like arguably the most important episode of Game of Thrones ever, where you can't see anything, no matter how dark you make it in your room, you know, like no matter how dark you could possibly get it, like you can't see anything. Right. And whereas like the Battle of Helm's Deep takes place in the middle of the night, is incredibly well lit. And when Peter Jackson was literally asked about it, he like, they're like, where's all this light coming from? He goes, the same place as the music. Like at the end of the day, like the medium is film, like adapt it as you need to. I think that's like what I don't know how we necessarily got on this tangent. I can't really remember, but what I think like what I applaud is when people make choices and they make them, like you said, almost not out of fear and not out of like a need for the lore and world building of their film to be immaculate. Like one of the things I loved about the Barbie movie is how Greta just yada yadas the whole like Barbie land versus the real world. How do you get back and forth? Like, what's the connection? Like, there's a lot, like, you could poke holes in it, but like, that's not important.
Mm-hmm.
No, like, it doesn't matter. We're not building this like long-term Barbie lore, even though it is IP, right? It's just for the convenience of this movie and the story that we're trying to tell. Just know that there's a connection between the two worlds on your fucking way.
Right. Like, it doesn't need to be a perfect jigsaw puzzle that we need to have every single piece that we can fit in exactly right, you know?
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with movies like that. If that's what the filmmaker's intention is, for you to be able to solve it, if it's a puzzle box mystery of some kind, that there are a series of clues left for you. But that also might not be someone's intention, and also just might not be possible with what's in someone's mind. And that's totally okay, and it is hard to retrain our minds to think like that, but I'm glad that we can have conversations like this, and I'm glad that we can move outside of that box.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And while we're at it, because you brought it to a really nice conclusion, so I'm not going to belabor the point too much, but while we're at it, fucking Star Wars, the best part about that shit was some of the mystery. We don't need every story in the universe ever to be told, so just fucking let's leave it.
What about that droid in minute 42 in the upper right-hand frame? I think
he's a pedophile. Did you know that? Oh, George Lucas wants you to know that droid is a pedophile. Minute 42 in Attack of the Clones. I know exactly which one you're talking about. Pedo droid. Coming soon. Coming soon to Disney Plus. Pedo droid. all right.
Let's John Favreau buys another house in Milan.
Exactly.
Emperor Palpatine, why don't you care about miners instead of miners on an island somewhere?
All right, what
funny moments.
Let's round this up with some funny moments.
Yes. So I have to nominate, the hardest I laughed in the movie was when they're shooting, when Tatro has been introduced as, you know, the heir apparent to the camp, and he first shows up and he has that moment where they're shooting him from outside of his mom's office, and he's walking around the office looking at some pictures, looking around, and he's not a very sentimental person in the movie, but in this moment we actually do feel like he is feeling the weight of like his mom being sick, right, or having these medical complications, and it's almost a little bit sad, and he's like walking around the room, and it's a close-up through the window from outside through the blinds, and then all of a sudden he jumps out of his pants and he goes, oh my god, there's a fucking human, and it's just what's his name,
Glenn.
Noah Galvin standing there with his hoodie on, and he's like, when you came in a couple of minutes ago, I was fixing the blinds, but you didn't notice me, so I didn't know what to do, so I just stood here. I don't know. I absolutely cried during that scene. I laughed so hard in the theater.
And then he's fixing the blinds again, like behind the curtain, like midway through the movie, when he like brings him in as his compatriot and trying to figure out how to sell the camp. That's something that's so good that Tatro does, is he's just like a worse movie makes Tatro like homophobic at the beginning, right? And he has to like get over that. And instead, Tatro is just like a dumbass, but like a genuinely good person who just like actually who's raised right by his mother, probably, and just loves everyone no matter what. And he just is like, hey Glenn, I can obviously see you're really talented and you want to, and you should perform as Joan, and at the end of you should be my mom is what Tatro decides from this movie, which is really fucking crazy actually. But he's sweet, you know, he's a sweet himbo.
I think we already mentioned a couple other ones. One we didn't really dig in on though is the Rotary Club dinner that turns into the interpretive immersive theater experience.
Carl!
Is one of the funniest fucking things, because them, like the kids just being like, I can't believe that this is their first immersive theater experience. We need to really make it good for them. And I don't know if either of you have ever been to an immersive theater experience, but it's very cool. But it's like on theme, right? So like that's like what I love about these kids are like, we need to go for it. And this girl's like, would you like more roles? Or should I tell you about how I lost my daughter? You know, it's just like, it just starts spiraling from there. There's actively like, you know, I what I loved about that is it is just like the perfect summation of like when you're a kid, like the more dramatic equals the more good. you know, and it was so funny. David Rashid being like, I want to go home now. Cracked me up, and he goes, how about we settle on $40? You really did not
like,
live.
You really screwed this one up. This is not what you promised.
Yeah.
He said, we're going to be served by the campers. Now, I didn't realize that was going to be the case. that scene is great because it's also such a good, it like shows the outside of the theater camp. Like it kind of shows like the worlds clashing, and it almost like after the scene is over, it's so funny, but you kind of realize like, wow, it really is so important that these kids get to come here for 4 weeks every year or something like that. Because this is lost on almost everyone else. And the teachers seem to even kind of realize that, but the kids are still so young that they probably don't at times realize that. I'm sure some of them do, but especially the younger ones. I mean, that scene is really funny.
I also need to nominate this is a small moment, but when what is Molly Gordon's character's name?
Rebecca Diane. Hilarious name too.
Yeah, Rebecca Diane, when she's doing like the past lives reading as part of her class.
Yes.
And when she just looks at the girl and she goes, oh, you're the oldest soul here, this is your last life. And yes. just a quick cut to the girl's face being like, oh, shit. Dude. One of the kids, she's like, you were President William Howard Taft.
One was hilarious.
Yeah.
You were President William Howard Taft. That was also seemed to be maybe a tiny little shot at, like, the kids from, you know, New York City, like, driving up to upstate. You know, It's like, even though they're into theater, their grandparents were still, like, fucking J.P. Morgan or whatever. Yeah. Like, those are great. Also, Molly Gordon, Rebecca Diane, like singing at the first like adult bonfire, and Io Edebiri is sitting there, and she's like singing that like weird ass song, playing that. Jed, do you know, is that a real instrument? That's like,
yes, it's
like
I can't. It's like a I think it's a harpsichord.
It's harpsichord. I always want to say seltzer, but that's wrong.
No, it's not a harpsichord. It's not a harpsichord. Sorry, harpsichord is like a tiny piano. I don't know why I got my wires crossed there. I'll find out what it is, but it's like that's a classic music teacher thing, because I think it has the full scale of the piano, but like in a strummable, like handheld thing. So it's kind of like a you see, what is it called, Chip?
It's a zither.
Zither.
And it's in, if you've ever seen, Evan may have seen this, The Third Man, the old noir with Orson Welles.
Yes.
That the zither is the theme of that movie, which is off-putting at first, but really works.
Oh, wow. Is it
a zither?
I thought for sure it was a zither.
No, because a zither has like a fixed, maybe it's like, it's definitely zither adjacent.
Perhaps it is like a violin viola situation, but I think it's zither adjacent at least.
Okay. Well, what's some other like
the idea of the nightly performance, like that is such a simple but amazing bit, that these kids have to be put to bed with a performance in their bunk. Like that is, that whole thing is so funny. And like Rebecca,
also, is it just one cabin? That was my other thing that I laughed at, is like, was it just one cabin that gets the performance, or are we just seeing the rotation?
But I think that was a little bit of a plot thing where like, let's just all pretend like they're almost all in here or something like that. I don't know. Chip,
I think it might be one cabin. I think there's definitely a bit of a utopian inclusive thing with a theater camp, which again, kind of plucks it a bit out of reality, but also lends itself to this movie being set in present day, because it can be a bit more naturally inclusive. If this was set in the 70s, as the film grain and lack of technology would lead you to believe, then it's like, you would still probably have a lot of different, you know, types of people, different walks of life, because that's what is often in the arts and theater. But in 2023, it's a little bit easier to just say, hey, all these people are here. They all exist. They all have their own preferences, and they all come from different backgrounds. And it's great. It plays especially well with Tatro being just a loving, cute, sweet person. But also, everyone just like kind of gets along, and there's also no like dumb romantic subplots with the kids. All the kids are just like there because they're so focused on their craft and on their art and on what they're bringing to the table, to the stage.
That's a good call. That's very well said. I'm gonna throw out the Post Malone it wasn't rehearsal, it was tryouts, right?
Tryouts. Yeah.
Yeah. The tryout scene. I just, that was so funny to me. Like the way he just started dancing was so relatable, because I feel like every bro like that I know dances exactly like that when they're like at a bar or something. And that's,
we have all up. The three of us have all danced like that at one point or another.
I'm sure 100%. And that scene was just so good.
Pillar light in me,
dude. Yeah, that
it's like, that is not appropriate. This is
we're not, don't internalize that feedback. Internalize the feedback. That cracked me up so hard. Not professional. And then that whole scene too, where we get the, this is a great song choice for her. I really believe her as a French prostitute. And then Rebecca Dan's like, Amos, and he goes, sorry, sex worker. Like sex, not like apologizing for basically being like the 10-year-old girl.
And she says, thank you.
Yeah,
so funny. I think that there's definitely. So Will Ferrell, executive producer, or I think he just produced this movie. And there was definitely some of that like ad-libby 2000s Ferrell style humor, which I think really, really played. I think that they shot like so much footage from this movie and only used very smart to make it a tight 90. Just made my heart swell. But they chopped it down to just those funniest ad-lib bits. And I think Ferrell actually makes a cameo with somebody on the phone, like from the bank. I think he's the guy who's telling Tatro that they're going to foreclose on the bank.
Oh, that's cool.
He's going to foreclose on the camp.
But Molly Gordon and Nick Liberman, they did an interview where they talked about how they did a ton of improv on this. Like there's a lot of improv and ad-lib, even from the kids. And like they were like, we wanted to like – have like an environment of like controlled chaos. So apparently it was just like a free for all in a lot of those scenes, which I think is like cool. Like, and especially we're doing it with like kid actors,
Cause they're so performative. The last thing I'll throw out for funniest scenes, when they are doing the montage of Glenn, you know, Noah Galvin having to run the props everywhere. And when he gets to the top of the hill and he just lays down and just rolls down the whole hill and then gets up and starts running again. It takes like three rolls to figure out what he's doing. And then you're like, oh, wow, it's just the fastest way you can think of to get to the bottom.
So funny. And then, I think we got to say the actual Joan Still musical. Is fucking hysterical.
Oh my god! Is
the whole like from the opening, girls can read in America, hysterical, and then the whole cocaine bit,
and then it's Boogie Nights.
Yeah, it's
the huge papier-mâché nose was killing me.
The papier-mâché nose, like the joke play, because he says that into his
papier-mâché nose. Yeah.
Pays off so well. Second best JFK joke of the year behind Oppenheimer. Jifka.
Yeah, I don't know. It was pretty good. Anything like I don't think any of us are going to give this like an A. Maybe. But I want to know, like, is there anything that you guys didn't particularly like before we round it out and give a score?
I wasn't. Just because it didn't feel like absolutely the main point of the movie, at least the parts of the movie that I loved, I wasn't completely in on like Amos and Rebecca Diane's dynamic. Like him just being bummed out a lot, or the whole scene of the mixer party, I was kind of left thinking like, wow, I feel like there's some funny stuff going on off camera here at this like event that I would like to see, that kind of became all about him just waiting for her. So a couple of those moments I thought slowed the movie down, but I understand why they cared so much about having that in there.
Understand.
Yeah. I think that I agree. There are those couple of like, it kind of just has to happen in any movie where there are moments where the jokes drop off and there's emotional moments. Right. It just so happens that I think it's the weakest part. And again, it's the part where I don't care that much about Ben Platt. I mean, he's like, Ben Platt is bang on average in this movie, which is an improvement, and I'm happy to see it for him in his career. And it is what it is. You have to make a movie a certain way sometimes, and this is how they made it.
Mm-hmm. I don't know why. I just thought of Ben Platt as Wonka. And I really feel like...
I think Ben Platt has thought about Ben Platt as Wonka.
But I think, like, that might be the deep darkness that we're looking for out of that character. You know, rather than the Timmy Chalamet, just a cool chocolate maker who developed...
He does have that mean streak that Wonka, I feel like, is famous for. Yeah,
I don't know. No, that's...
I like talking about Willy Wonka like he's a real person. You know, we all know and love
my friend Willy Wonka.
We all know Willy's music. He's a great guy, I swear. He kills children, but other than that, just quality guy.
Allegedly. Byproduct of
you gotta get in the chocolate genius. Game. Yeah. You can't get in the chocolate game without killing a couple kids. I completely derailed what I was gonna say with my own Wonka point. But this is what I was gonna say. In many ways, to me, and this is the last point I want to make before we grade it, because of what you guys are talking about and like the pacing of this movie, it kind of felt like just a 2000s comedy, right? Of like, all right, we understand that we have to put this emotional weight in, but you know what? Here it is, and we're not gonna linger, and we're gonna go out on a high note. You know, I think they did a really good job of just like giving us what, like we said, like the necessary plot machinations. But I didn't think it lingered too much. And so in many ways, I'm kind of like, it reminded me of like the Wedding Crashers, you know, the way those are paced, where the first like hour, you're just like, wow, like what a riot. And then you kind of get to the slow part and you're like, okay. And then it ends on another, you know, high note. And I think that did that in a very late 2000s or mid 2000s to early 2010s kind of way for me.
Low stakes, high fun.
Yeah, you guys want to grade this? Let's get out of Doge.
Yeah, I'll start with an A minus. You doubted that an A would be here, but I think for what a musical theater movie with a cast that is 72% kids, starring basically having Ben Platt in the lead role, if you were to just pitch that to me on the street, I think I would turn up my headphones and walk away. And I just like basically smiled for 90 minutes and had just like a great time. Like it's mm-hmm. This is like one of the better comedies of the last few years for me. 100%.
Love it. I gave it a B, but you're getting like a really solid B. Like would watch again. Like if occasionally I have friends that text me and be like, hey, we're looking for a movie to watch tonight. What's good and what's on streaming? 1000% gonna toss Theater Camp their way if they haven't seen it. You know, I immediately texted my sisters. I was like, you guys gotta watch Theater Camp. You'll love it. You know, I think anybody that loves Pitch Perfect, this is like a much more like grown up. But it feels like Pitch Perfect for grownups without a lot of like the kind of like over the top slapsticky comedy.
I do have a soft spot for Pitch Perfect. I would talk about those movies on this podcast.
Yeah. I mean, I would too. I like those movies. So you're like, you abide by Pitch Perfect 2 and 3. Hold on.
I said I would talk about those movies on this podcast. I didn't full throatedly endorse.
You said I have a lot of affection for those movies. I have a lot of affection for the first movie.
I never said that.
Cars trilogy or Pitch Perfect trilogy.
You can't tell me I said that. Artificial intelligence, deepfake. What did you say, Evan?
I said Cars trilogy or Pitch Perfect trilogy.
Oh, come on! Don't ask me that question.
That's the verses
we've all been waiting. That's my favorite children.
The verses. Pitch Perfect 2 versus Cars 3.
Twilight Eclipse in there.
Ooh. I don't want to step on anybody's thing, but should we do a Elizabeth Banks cinematic universe, Pitch Perfect versus Cocaine Bear?
That would require me to watch Cocaine Bear
versus Evan. Hit us with your ranking.
I'm gonna go B, pretty close to a B plus. I almost got right in between you guys, but I think B is where it is, and I totally agree. really good comedy. And this year, looking back, a few good comedies. I thought No Hard Feelings was good. I thought Blackberry was good. Dungeons and Dragons pretty much is a comedy. I thought that was good. And absolutely. I mean, I told as soon as I got back from the theater, I told Emily, we're definitely going to watch it again. I would be happy to return to this movie. I felt like it was one of those movies. It's my favorite type of comedy where the jokes are coming so quickly. I did feel like I missed some just because I was still laughing and like, you know, thinking about the joke before it, which I can really appreciate.
Yeah. No, and I think those are great because those ones have staying power because you're not waiting around for the joke that inevitably was in the trailer that got you there, right? Yeah. It's often the joke in between the jokes that is funny, or like the the follow-up punchline is sometimes even funnier than the actual punchline itself. But I agree with you. Glad that we all liked it. I'm happy that great suggestion. Was it Chip? You suggested this, right?
Chip.
Theater guy. I know you just picked it because you wanted to shit on some kid actors, but look at you. Your heart grew like five sizes.
And now I've got like maybe it's signal of the year, but this is like in the outskirts of the top five of the year.
Let's go, baby.
I don't know. Like looking back on my list for the year and I'm like, I don't know. I think I like this more than like a John Wick 4, for example, you know?
Molly,
did
Gordon,
you like it more than
director?
Air?
I like it more than Air. I think so.
That's actually a really good comp, Evan. I think I like them a very
similar. Well, the ones that I thought about were like Air, Blackberry, No Hard Feelings were kind of all right around similar area for me. So I think it is right around that area.
Yeah, it's either like No Hard Feelings versus this would be an interesting one, just like from like a which one I like better. Because I really liked No Hard Feelings a lot the very first time. And not that I disliked it the second time, but again, like kind of what you're talking about, Evan, where I don't feel like the jokes are coming as fast in No Hard Feelings. And on rewatch, it wasn't like I laughed, but I was more like laughing when Rachel laughed when I was showing it to her versus like laughing again because the situation was so funny. All right, guys. Thank you so much, as always, for listening. If you haven't already, follow us on Twitter at Flicking Scream, on Instagram at Flicking and Screaming. Join the conversation at flickingandscreaming.com. Mr. Evan Fagundes has a new blog up on the website. We're going to open next week's show talking about that new blog. So go read it and then come join the conversation next week. I know we already said we were going to do Any Given Sunday versus Remember the Titans this week. Had some scheduling conflicts. We bumped that to next week. We will be talking about the Titans. We will be talking some football, going from the theater kids to the jocks. That's what we do on the pod, and we do it well.
That's good.
And remember, before we say goodbye, the pod isn't home, but is it kind of? I think it kind of is for Flicking and Screaming. Evan Fagundes, Jed Sprague, JT Chipman. Bye, everybody.
See ya.
See ya.
And now, the starting lineup for your
Gangsters. What's up, guys?
You're a slacker.
MVP.
I'm not going to debate you, Jerry.
God bless the internet.